This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane. Just when it looked like tensions between Russia and Ukraine might have been easing, new complications arisen. Ukrainian government's blaming Moscow for a massive cyber attack that's continued for a second day. Europe correspondent Nick Doll reports from the Ukrainian capital, Kyiv.
In the sky over Kyiv, a drone with six propellers hovers over central Maidan Square. People on the ground may not have heard the whirring noise, but they couldn't miss what the drone was towing, a massive Ukrainian flag. It was for Unity Day, an impromptu event organised for February 16, the same day that some Western intelligence sources had predicted a Russian invasion. Russia's always insisted it doesn't want a war, and it had announced the drawdown of some of its forces who'd been on military drills near Ukraine's border. But in Brussels, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg told a meeting of the alliance's defence ministers that Russia was actually increasing troop numbers.
We do not see any sign of de-escalation on the ground. No withdrawals of troops or equipment. This may, of course, change. However, what we see today is that Russia maintains a massive invasion force ready to attack.
NATO is now considering sending more battle groups into Eastern Europe. US Secretary of State Antony Blinken says Vladimir Putin's strategy of pressuring Ukraine is backfiring.
He says he wants NATO further away from Russia. NATO has only gotten more united, more solidified as a result of the threat of Russian aggression. And of course, for defensive reasons, is moving more forces closer to Russia.
Despite weeks of US warnings about a potentially imminent invasion, none has occurred. But a massive cyber attack has. Some major Ukrainian banks and the defence ministry were overwhelmed with malicious traffic, taking some services down, and it's continued for a second day. AM asked some Ukrainians in Kyiv who they thought might be responsible.
I presume, I don't want to fall into irrational exuberance while giving options. My general presumption is that somebody who is staying next to our borders...
Tatiana was in no doubt directly blaming Russia. She says she's tired of feeling under pressure. She said she felt like marching into Moscow and putting the Ukrainian flag there. The Kremlin's denied any involvement in the attack, but Ukraine's government says Moscow has the motive and the means. Mykola Balan from Ukraine's Center for Strategic Communications and Security says Russian troops massing on the border ensures a certain type of pressure, but interrupting vital services like banking creates another.
They try to portray Ukraine as a weak state that couldn't secure its own business infrastructure and cyber infrastructure.
NATO's describing this type of pressure as the new normal for Europe. It's one people here in Ukraine are already well accustomed to. This is Nick Doll in Kyiv reporting for AM.
One of Australia's most powerful former policemen, Mick Fuller, is in line for a lucrative board position with horse racing body Racing New South Wales. Now an ABC investigation can reveal that before the New South Wales Police Commissioner retired, he co-owned racehorses with two businessmen who became embroiled in criminal investigations or won lucrative police contracts. Mr. Fuller didn't declare his racing interests to the state government, raising concerns he breached anti-corruption rules. This exclusive report from ABC Investigation's Sean Rubenstein-Dunlop.
Racing and of the day was away sweetly, with also going forward there as Time to Remember is about a neck in front of the stablemate of the day. There's Mad Magic going forward quickly.
A keen gambler and horse racing fan, after 3 decades in a police uniform, Mick Fuller might soon join the board of Racing New South Wales. But an ABC investigation has revealed that from 2015, before he became police commissioner, and then into his term as the top cop, Mr. Fuller and a group of senior police acquired shares in racehorses from a repeat doping offender. The horses were Once Upon a Time and Mad Magic.
From Mad Magic, a little bit green on the outside of the day.
Mr. Fuller and other senior police didn't declare the shares in potential breach of anti-corruption rules. Patrick Sadie is a former commissioner at the state's police watchdog.
There's very little doubt, given the inherent dangers of involvement in the racehorse industry and indeed the gaming industry generally, that declarations should have been made, whether it be Mr. Fuller or head of any agency.
Under the police code of conduct, Mick Fuller was required to make annual declarations to the government of any private interests, social activities or relationships which could or could be perceived to influence his decisions. Mr. Sadie again.
Full disclosure is a very important part of the maintaining the integrity of an organisation. What does he do if a major investigation or indeed a minor investigation is carried out in relation to any of those people with whom he has a partnership in a racehorse? It speaks for itself as to why it's such a high-risk situation.
The ABC has learned two of Mr. Fuller's racehorse co-owners went on to be targeted in high-profile criminal investigations. After Mr. Fuller became commissioner, the police awarded a $3 million catering contract to one of those businessmen, David Levy, whose charges over asbestos dumping were later dropped. Mr. Levy employed the husband of another senior officer in his food business. State Greens MP David Shoebridge is calling for a full investigation into the police force's ties to the racing industry and its procurement decisions.
This is one that comprehensively fails the pub test. There should be a red line here. Senior police should not have any interests in any part of the gambling industry. And I think this requires an independent investigation to be done of all of those procurement decisions to ensure public money went where it was going to get best value for money.
Mick Fuller declined an interview, but in a statement said the ABC's questions were derogatory to thoroughbred racing. He said he'd never breached any policies and claimed he was cleared of wrongdoing by an independent review of the catering contracts. Five police officers or officials who co-owned racehorses with Mr. Fuller are still in senior roles. His successor, Commissioner Karen Webb, has told the ABC any alleged misconduct will be investigated. She's promised to strengthen police force rules if needed.
That report from Sean Rubenstein Dunlop and Dylan Welch from ABC Investigations. The latest unemployment figures will be out this morning, and we'll know then if the Prime Minister is getting close to his goal of getting a number with a 3 in front of it, as he puts it. The national jobless rate is currently 4.2%. In regional Australia, it's even lower, 3.8%, which means employers are struggling to find enough people to fill vacancies. Nick Grimm reports.
Case Mannix has been advertising for new staff for her accountancy firm in the regional Victorian city of Bendigo, but the response has been disappointing.
And what we're finding is that we have a continued challenge in finding people. There seems to be a bit of a human shortage with professionally skilled recruits at a more experienced level, but also at a graduate level. We're finding there's just not a lot of people in the market and availability is very tight at the moment.
And Kate Mannix isn't alone in struggling to find the right person for the job as the nation's unemployment rate slides to its lowest levels in decades. December's figure came in at just 4.2%, a result celebrated by the Prime Minister in Parliament last week.
We're on track as a nation, Mr. Speaker, to have the lowest rate of unemployment in this country in 50 years, Mr. Speaker. This is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for our country, Mr. Speaker. In the months ahead over the course of 2022, for us to have an unemployment rate with a 3 in front of it.
But in regional Australia, unemployment is already below that level, sitting at 3.8%. And the chief economist and acting CEO of the Regional Australia Institute, Kim Horton, says it's in country Victoria where vacancies are highest.
Yes, it's become very tight in regional Victoria. It's been significant growth across the year, 60-odd percent growth in vacancies over the year, and employers are really very keen to find staff.
So that's certainly the case in Bendigo we've had now for quite a long time.
That's Robert Stevenson from B Bendigo, the regional city's business council. Like many other areas, it's been struggling with the problem of how to prevent workers from leaving for the big cities. And even those headed in the opposite direction aren't always a solution.
More recently, following COVID, it's been exacerbated because we've seen people move from metro areas into regional areas, but a lot of them under the working from home kind of provisions have still been attached to their Melbourne jobs. So they've been physically in the regions, but they've still been working in Melbourne and not actually adding to the local skills base.
And Kate Mannix says the shortages are sometimes leading to local businesses jockeying with each other to recruit from the region's existing pool of workers.
Yeah, that's right. So it's sort of not the great resignation, but just the great reshuffle.
That's Kate Mannix, CEO of AFS Chartered Accountants. Nick Grimm reporting there. A visiting American general is strongly backing Australia's decision to spend billions of dollars on new army fighting vehicles and tanks, saying they'll be essential for future conflicts. With China flexing its growing military might in the region, the commander of the US Army in the Pacific is in Canberra to discuss closer cooperation. Here's defence correspondent Andrew Green.
Just hours after flying into Canberra, the US Army's Pacific Commander paid tribute to Australia's fallen at the War Memorial. General Charlie Flynn is on a three-day visit to discuss growing ties between the US and Australian armies.
It's just really good to be back here, to see the advances that we've made together. And I'm just really excited about the future because I think there's just some great opportunities.
He's being hosted by Australian Army Chief Rick Burr, and both generals are exploring how to expand existing cooperation.
We both share that same interest of not just strengthening our own bilateral relationship, but using that as a framework for more multilateral activities as well.
As China's influence grows in the Indo-Pacific, both nations want to broaden regional training opportunities, particularly the biennial military exercises known as Talisman Sabre.
Create opportunities for multiple countries to come together to, again, deepen our relationships, seek opportunities for interoperability. And I think that that is a powerful counterweight to some of the destabilizing activities that do happen in the region.
Soon, the federal government is expected to unveil the winning design for the Australian Army's new $30 billion infantry fighting vehicles. And just last month, it confirmed it would spend over $3 billion on new American tanks, a decision that's drawn some criticism. General Charlie Flynn is strongly endorsing the expensive purchases.
I believe that in the future, for a peer or near peer fight, that the impact of combined arms maneuver, particularly in dense urban areas, you're going to want armor forces. You're going to need tanks.
Lieutenant General Rick Burr argues the Australian Army's modernisation is essential.
As part of everything that we're doing, there is an eye to what we call human-machine teaming. So robotics and autonomous systems working in conjunction with our manned systems to give us more scale, more mass, more effects over a broader area.
After visiting Canberra, General Flynn will fly to Brisbane, and with COVID travel restrictions easing, many more US military figures are expected to come to Australia in 2022.
Andrew Green. China's President Xi Jinping has ordered Hong Kong to do everything it can to get COVID cases to zero. It's been one of the few places in the world sticking with an elimination goal, yet it's struggling to do that, reporting around 4,000 cases a day. Here's East Asia correspondent Bill Birtles.
Outside some Hong Kong hospitals, patients are now lying in beds or sitting on stools, waiting for space inside to free up. An overcrowding crisis partly sparked by a policy not suited for an outbreak. Up until this week, Hong Kong authorities were forcing anyone who tested positive to be hospitalised. In the face of thousands of new cases each day, it's now been scrapped. Sarah Ho is a doctor from the city's hospital authority.
The current pandemic situation is very serious. The number of people waiting for medical treatment has surged. We now have to treat some of them outside.
Like in Sydney and Melbourne during the Delta waves, authorities are trying to roll out more vaccines and ordering residents to isolate at home. But unlike Australia, there's no path out. And China's leader Xi Jinping, now all but completely in charge of Hong Kong, has reminded local leader Carrie Lam that her overriding mission is to stabilise and control the outbreak. She's conceded some mistakes in her handling of it.
The problem we are facing is, given the magnitude of this fifth wave, it has outgrown our capacity. So I will have to say it very clearly that we have no plans for any widespread city lockdown, as you have seen in some of the other places.
The pressure for lockdowns may grow with Xi Jinping's intervention, but Ben Cowley, a top epidemiologist at Hong Kong University, says a lockdown wouldn't be easy to do.
We could go to a citywide stay-at-home order, but that would only be a temporary solution because the virus would still spread within families, it would still spread within key workers, it would most likely still spread within buildings.
Professor Cowley says a lockdown at this point would only work if combined with mainland China's surveillance tools and the ability to isolate huge numbers of people and test them rapidly, something Hong Kong doesn't have.
At the moment, we have about 10,000 people waiting for admission, and that's at the moment.
He expects most people in Hong Kong in the coming months will get infected with Omicron. But with Beijing in control, that won't mean living with the virus. China's government is increasingly drawing a distinction, saying its COVID-zero approach saves lives and cares more about human rights than countries that live with the virus and tolerate some deaths. This is Bill Birtles in Taipei, reporting for AM.
During the past 2 years, COVID has forced millions of us to retreat from families and friends. But in Japan, the problem of loneliness and isolation has spiralled. The rates of marriage and childbirth are falling as more and more young Japanese choose to stay single and childless. So why is Japan becoming a solo society? Correspondent Jake Sturmer has been trying to find out.
It's time for a quick cut and style at the salon for Japanese woman Sayaka Kinjo's pride and joy. Unimaru is one of her four babies. Well, fur babies, to be precise. Today, she and the Maltese Dachshund are off to a photo shoot.
Hi.
Sayaka is one of millions of young, single Japanese. And at 29, with a good career in the fashion industry, she's not interested in following the old rules of society here. No kids and no marriage.
Right now, there is nothing I can't do. I'm managing everything by myself, and I can pay for myself, so I'm not having any problems.
After World War II, traditionally, men would go to work and women stayed home to run the house and look after the kids. That led to an economic miracle for Japan, but that was shattered when the asset bubble burst in the 1990s. Women have increasingly moved into the workforce, but the long hours can make it hard to socialise outside of the office, and government statistics show that working women do five times the housework of their husbands. So the idea of marriage and kids is unappealing to many, like Sayaka and her friend Rika, who also brought her two dogs for a photo shoot.
Many Japanese men think women stay at home and take care of the family while men work in society. That idea's not bad, but I'd like them to be more cooperative with things at home. Women also want to work in society, so I feel it's hard to meet someone in Japan.
Marriage and birth numbers have been steadily falling for decades, and this, coupled with Japan's ageing population, is considered a national crisis. The economic consequences could be profound. If there aren't enough workers, whose taxes will pay for the pensions and healthcare for the growing numbers of elderly? And Japan has another problem. More than 1 million people are so stressed by the burdens and expectations of family and society, they've cut themselves off from the world entirely. It's so acute, it has its own word, hikikomori. 40-year-old Hidehiro Shimasu is one of them. He's barely left his room for almost 2 decades. He spent days mentally preparing to allow me into his room inside his parents' house.
There is a lot of peer pressure and homogeneity in Japan, and there is not much tolerance for people who act differently or live differently. For example, people who don't go to school or can't work have a hard time getting out into the community. For example, if you go out on a weekday, people think you have a day off.
So far, efforts to address these problems have been failing, but the government now has a dedicated minister for loneliness and a task force has been established, but there's still a long way to go.
Jake Sturmer reporting. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC's News Daily podcast. Prince Andrew's fall from grace is complete after he settled in the rape case brought by Australian-based woman Virginia Giuffre. Today, the ABC's royal correspondent Juliet Reardon on the journey of a disgraced prince and what it means for Epstein's other victims. Look for ABC News Daily on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.